Gas. My name is Vic Coring. I'm the chairman of the committee, and with us we have the vice chair, Representative Samuels. We also have Representative McGuire and Representative Gardner. Representative Catula is absent due to illness, so we've excused her. I'd like to make an announcement regarding cell phone use. I've noticed other committees, there have been cell phones that have gone off. Now, I'm not going to say you cannot use a cell phone or cannot allow one to ring here, but I will say if it does go off, there will be a $20 fine. And that's going to be our donut fine for the committee members here. So if we do hear a cell phone go off, there will be a $20 fine. The purpose of this meeting is twofold. We're going to hear House Bill 32, which is sponsored by myself. That's the funding legislation for Arctic Power. And then we're also going to have an overview by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. And I do appreciate the folks from AOGA who've taken time to fly down here and their willingness to present to the committee issues relating to oil and gas taxation. I think what we're going to do, in light of the fact that our caucus meeting prevented us from being able to start at 5 o'clock, is to just present the legislation of House Bill 32. We'll take the public testimony on it, and then we'll hold the bill over until the next meeting so that we can get right to AOGA. This is a courtesy to that group. Don't see any other legislators in the audience. So at this time, what I'd like to do is present House Bill 32. Now, that's, as I mentioned, my legislation. I'll just paraphrase from the sponsor statement here, but for many of you, it's familiar legislation because we have had a similar bill in the past that we've approved. Now, what the bill does is appropriates $1.2 million from the general fund to fund Arctic Power. It's a private nonprofit organization that advocates for the opening of ANWR. And as far as the specifics in terms of what the money will be spent on, I will turn it over to Kevin Hand momentarily and have him explain all of that. But it's to fund their budget, or at least a portion of their budget, so that they can advertise and cover related expenses as it relates to advocating for the opening of ANWR and encouraging congressmen to vote in the affirmative on legislation that they'll have before them in D.C. In the legislation, it also includes $100,000 to the native village of Kaktovik for their community outreach in an effort to gain the support of opening the refuge as well, and that will be explained as well by Kevin. The way I look at this legislation, some might question, well, why are we funding something like this? Is this really an appropriate government function and so forth? I look at this as a small amount of money when you consider the potential payoff. There's estimates of as much as 10 billion barrels of oil, as many of you have probably heard, as far as potential of ANWR. And if we're lucky enough to get legislation passed and signed into law in Congress and signed by the President, the potential return obviously is just going to be just phenomenal and well worth the investment of $1.2 million, in my opinion. As you know, what we're trying to do is to get the coastal plain of ANWR open. It's not ANWR as a whole. It's just the coastal plain. It's a small stretch of land on the very northern coast of ANWR. And in the course of exploring and developing that area, we're hopeful and actually expecting that there will likely be some additional unforeseen discoveries that could be added to the potential that is estimated up there that could further reduce our country's need for imported oil and help with our trade deficit and perhaps even improve our national security. As I'd mentioned, Arctic Power is a nonprofit private group. They've been in existence for the last 12 years now. They've received funding from us in the past. In fact, I think the appropriation 2 years ago was, if I remember right, $1.8 million. Did I say that number right, Charisse? And we really feel that the timing is critical on this, too. We have a very opportune situation here where we have a Congress that's very amenable to opening ANWR, we believe anyway. We've got a substantial number of pro-development people who believe in enhancing our oil and gas industry and that would likely support ANWR. So the timing is right to really push this issue now. And then, of course, President Bush is very supportive as well, and he's pledged to sign legislation if it were to be produced from Congress. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Kevin Hand, who I assume is on the line. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
I'd like to have Kevin delve into some more of the details here, including more specifically what the monies would be used for. Before you start, though, Kevin, I failed to announce the time of the opening of the meeting here, which was 5:30. And we also have been joined by Representative Roekberg. Thank you, Norm. So, Kevin, go ahead.
Very great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Hand. I am Executive Director of Arctic Power. And for the record, Arctic Power is a nonprofit grassroots organization of citizens and businesses from across Alaska and across the nation advocating for the responsible exploration and development of the resources contained in the plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, namely the 1002 area, as it's commonly known, referred to as a portion of the Anilka, the Anilka Code of 1002. And so my intention here today, Mr. Chairman, is that the committee and the members are quite knowledgeable about this issue. We don't need to discuss the pros and cons of the issue of the merits itself regarding we're talking a small footprint in a very large area of land and such. And therefore, I propose to speak directly about the activities and the things that Arctic Power is undertaking to reach that goal. Others will speak to the merit of why Arctic Power is effective and what we do. And I think I'd like to speak to is how we go about doing it as a committee. So, of course, if there's anything that gets left behind as far as the rudimentary things of the issue of the debate itself, please stop me. I'd be happy to extrapolate on any of those as necessary.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roekberg.
Did we have a hearing on this last time?
We have not had a hearing on this legislation, though. This is the first time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. That was another one.
Okay.
What was that? I'm confused.
Well, we had the, and we have, of course, we have what might be confusing matters. We have had similar legislation in years past that you and I have heard probably two, three times over the years.
Well, never you're ready for a motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the interest in moving the bill. Thank you. Kevin, go ahead.
And yes, if you can come back any time, I'd be happy to cease and desist as necessary for a motion to take place. But I'll continue.
Yeah, if you could be brief, and in light of the fact that we have folks here waiting to make a presentation.
Sure, understand that. And I know the folks at Aona and Judy and such probably have some very entertaining information and quite interesting, so I will make haste here to let you get to that.
Great.
We're active with our education and advocacy program currently underway in Washington, D.C. With that program, we provide a great amount of information to our delegation and other members of Congress, from caribou numbers to statistics on oil spills, to our nation's dependence upon foreign oil, which is ever increasing and problematic in a number of ways. We facilitate congressional tours to ANWR, currently working with the Senate Energy Committee and the Secretary of Interior on a trip to ANWR that will take place this March, members of Congress that we're focusing on. As well as we send the opposite direction delegations of Alaskans to D.C. To provide our perspective and our feelings regarding the ANWR issue. And that often involves an Alaska Native voice, perspective of the Alaska Native, as well as the business community and their perception of ANWR and how it comes into play with the Alaska economy. And, of course, as well as legislators who can speak from the public policy standpoint. And overall, those have been very receptive of folks and that they... Congressional leaders really want to understand how folks who live here feel about the issue of ANWR, and that carries a lot of sway with them, and so we continue in that earnest as well. The important facts to consider here, and I'll run through them very quickly, the important fact to consider regarding Arctic Power and appropriations and the activities that we do is that there is no one else out there focused on advocating on behalf of Alaska for ANWR besides our congressional delegation. We know that we could not list on one piece of paper all of the groups out there that are opposing us in this endeavor. There are a small number of us that are actually proponents of this issue besides our elected officials. And this endeavor, we're outspent many times over by the environmental organizations. It's an impossibility, unfortunately, to match their resources. And it speaks to the resources that they are able to raise as they pound the table on this issue, but also the resources they are utilizing against us at every step of the way as we hope to see congressional passage or presidential signature on ANWR legislation. Arctic Power has undertaken unprecedented teamwork in Congress. We have real believers in place, real quickly. For example, Representative Richard Pombo with the House Resources Committee just put out a press release today, the U.S. House Resources Committee did, that showed a new poll result. The majority of Americans support responsible development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Mr. Chairman, your meeting is very timely today to coincide with that. And more importantly, also out of this new poll, is that when educated with the facts, and I do mean the facts of common sense development in ANWR, that the amount of support with Americans jumps up considerably when they are given a common sense approach to responsible development in Anwar, that the numbers of folks out there in middle stream America, it increases a dramatic amount that folks, when they understand that we can do it with in an environmentally safe manner and with the latest technology, the vast amount of Americans do support drilling in Anwar. This, the reason I point this out is this is all done through and facilitated by Arctic Power. In fact, it was Arctic Power poll that was utilized to create this press release from the U.S. House of Resources Committee. It made just brief mention of Arctic Power. I think it referenced our website, www.anwar.org. More importantly, of course, this was paid for by Arctic Power. As you realize, this costs money. And these, of course, the resources and things that we're looking to continue to do with state help and the grant appropriation. But these are all very important, and mostly they're very important in that they provide our delegations and our allies in Congress the tools and the information they need to actively promote our issue. And, of course, that is what we undertake here at Arctic Power, and we look to further that cause. And so just today's press release is a small example of something that does not have Arctic Power's name or insignia all over it, but yet is the direct result of our activities and our actions. of course, Senator Pete Domenici of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee is pushing hard for Anwar in Alaska. He will hopefully be instrumental in the budget reconciliation process. And he is also another person of the power position that utilizes Arctic Power for assistance in making his case for Anwar. And, of course, we support our delegation every step of the way. We have a number of things. I'll just touch on them real briefly here. We have a highly touted database that is respected a great deal on Capitol Hill. It has in it every meeting that has ever taken place with an Alaskan and a member of Congress regarding the issue of Anwar that we had to do with. That goes back, of course, now some 15-odd years, and it is useful that we can sit down and pull up any information, whether a congressman from Oregon's son beats him over the head at Thanksgiving dinner of why his dad supports Anwar. Will we help him combat those sort of things? We have a a database there that allows us to best utilize our resources in trying to sway members of Congress. We do a great deal of data mining, that is to say that putting together materials, advocacy pieces with state-by-state stats, whether that be revenue generated, jobs generated in every state of the union, and of course the nation as a whole, to make our case to open Anwar. I just mentioned the survey is how Americans feel today, and what messages resonate with Americans to further the case for Anwar, and just as important, what messages work for those of our allies who already support the Anwar cause in Washington, D.C., what messages they can use to bolster their argument if that may fall on folks who may not necessarily agree with them back at home, so to speak. So real quick, needed to move on. Arctic Power is unmatched with our coalition buildings. Just hit on a few of the high points for you here quickly. We have done unmatched coalition building with unions in Congress. This progress was not made before Arctic Power came into the game. Another one of these things that you don't know about, but of course Arctic Power is actively working on sort of behind the scenes. We pushed hard in the past, and including in just 2 years ago when Anwar made it out of the U.S. House, that it was through the help of Anwar that we received. We got 35 Democrats on board who previously were not supporters of the Anwar issue. Through our coalition, we also, with the helps of the unions, pushing hard on those members, we came across newfound support in the U.S. House that, of course, allows us to get that through. And those are just small highlights. We have Energy Stewardship Alliance, which is a wholly owned and operated subsidiary of the Arctic Power Energy Stewardship Alliance, the alliance of over 500 organizations, from seniors to business coalitions to ranchers to farmers. It's a very good grassroots mechanism for us out there to get our advocacy materials in the hands of a large number of people in a very short period of time with which they can contact their delegation or their editorial boards and take that grassroots advocacy to the street, so to speak, and that, of course, occurs nationwide. We're continuing on these other inroads briefly as far as in other ways, for example, a Jewish congressional delegation, the African-American Congressional Caucus, other ways that Alaska hasn't historically trying to combat the Anwar issue or make strides in Congress the Anwar issue. Arctic Power is undergoing, is making a lot of those inroads and undergoing a lot of work in that regard. And again, those are things that don't necessarily make the press, and you don't notice Arctic Power is out there on the front lines pushing But of course, those are things that do reap benefit for us as well. And so again, much of our efforts are below the radar. We do weekly meetings with press secretaries in D.C. to unify the message on ANWR, to share our latest information so that all the press secretaries in the House, for example, proceed in an organized manner, a unified group. All the key staff members of our delegation and, of course, the supporters that we have who are driving the issue in Congress, we have weekly meetings with their key staff that we have a unified message. These are all things that are facilitated by Arctic Power that sort of go unnoticed, go under the radar, if you will. All three offices, despite what some folks may think, all three offices of our delegation have requested support and active help from Arctic Power since January 1st. That's in the way of information, talking points, educational materials, you name it, that Arctic Power has been at the assistance of our delegation in helping them make the case for ANWR with their colleagues in Washington. That includes, of course, the governor, loads of packets that just mentioned that governor recently made a speech to a conference of governors where 40 governors were armed with ANWR advocacy materials and left to go home and beat the drum in their home states as far as the need for a responsible source of supply of oil here within our own borders. And of course, ANWR provides that. Talking points to the Attorney General, of course, legislators, as you know, we provide talking points here. Just this week, I filled a number of requests for legislators going elsewhere to speak with various folks, their colleagues from other states, and arming them with advocacy materials to further our cause in that regard. And so this is just a sampling of activities that are not, they're undertaken by Arctic Power, that are not overtly done by Arctic Power, but require effort, time, and resources for it to accomplish. But unless one were in those circles, understand that really Arctic Power is driving
Kevin?
The force behind a lot of those issues.
Kevin? Yes. Kevin, excuse me for interrupting. You have the votes to move the bill out of committee, so my recommendation is that you, with all due respect, sir, and you're providing a very good testimony, and I appreciate that, but if you could be so kind to wrap it up and say within a minute or two,
absolutely,
that would be very helpful.
Chairman, I understand that. Just try to share as information as possible, and, yes. And I do understand, of course, your time constraints there. Real quickly, in summary, we're going to face considerable challenges this year. The green community is not going to go away without fight. I understand we have come across, they're going to come out with a new caribou study to combat and sort of inflame the environmental arguments in that regard regarding caribou numbers. And these attacks are only going to increase as we come to fruition here and come to votes on the floor of the House and the Senate. Arctic Power is ready. We just require the resources to accomplish all that we are asked to do by the delegation and others. And private fundraising is undertaken in earnest. I think they expand upon that as necessary. But we definitely believe, to reiterate the comments that you made, Mr. Chairman, that the benefits to Alaska far outweigh any costs, that the revenues that would come online to the state of Alaska are considerable by any definition, and that the small investments in things such as Arctic Power and the advocacy mechanisms are a very small investment in order to reap a great reward for the future of Alaska.
Amen to that.
I know that's shared by a number of you folks there in the committee room. So with that, I will conclude and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that testimony. A lot of good words there. I just didn't want to encourage you to push our luck here because we're ready to move that bill. But you did a good job. We thank you for that. Okay. And before I actually entertain a motion on the bill, I wanted to make sure that there were not any questions from the committee members or any comments. Are there any at this point? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move this bill out of committee. Are there any motion? Or is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And I assume that motion is with individual recommendations, including the accompanying zero fiscal note.
That's exactly what I meant.
Okay. So the motion has been...
Zero fiscal note?
Well, excuse me. Actually, it would be... I saw a zero fiscal note in there from
a
DNR.
Attached fiscal note.
So there is a motion by Representative Samuels to move this legislation out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, which should be $1.3 million. Is there any objection to moving the bill as noted? Seeing none, the legislation is moved from committee. Thank you very much. So with that, we will move to our next item on the agenda. And that item is, of course, the presentation by our friends from AOGA, the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. We have with us Judy Brady and her staff. Judy, thank you for flying down from Anchorage, and good to have you here like always. So I will turn it over to you, Judy. Thank you.
Those are for you.
Chairman and members of the committee, good evening. My name is Judy Brady. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. We're a private nonprofit corporation with 18 members, unfortunately. 2 months ago, we had 21 members.
Judy, I just wanted to make a comment here, which I think is appropriate, even though your focus is not necessarily the issue of the governor's or the administration's taxes and the effect on the economy, but perhaps you could touch on that at some point. But that is, today is a significant day. It's February 1st, which is the day that those taxes go into effect. So I just wanted to just note the significance of this particular day.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
We need the light to come on.
And your comments on that issue and your compass piece are very much appreciated.
No, not those lights.
Welcome.
Yes.
I'll get out of your way, too.
Maybe it's going to come back on.
Do you know about that computer?
That's it.
No.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, on behalf of AOGA and its members, we'd like to thank you for allowing us to make this presentation. We're well aware that it's late and people are tired.
Judy, in light of the fact you're having technical problems there, is your handout here the same thing that you're going to project on the screen then?
Yes, it is. What we were going to try to do because of the lateness of the hour is to go through this very fast, just an overview rather than going through an hour and a half of presentation. But even going through it very fast is going to take about 45 minutes altogether.
I think that would be fine.
That's all right.
Sure.
This is going to be an overview of Oil and Gas 101 that some of you have already heard, and then an overview of the economic limit factor, and then a short closing. And the reason I know that you asked us to put this together was because there is so much interest in oil and gas tax right now. And so this is the beginning. This is the mechanics part. We're very lucky today because we have with us Tom Williams, who is chairman of the AOGA Tax Committee. And he is also probably the expert witness for any kind of tax discussion in Alaska. So I'm going to spend some time talking about who he is for a couple of those of you who don't know him. Like many of us, he came to Alaska fresh out of college in 1973 for a temporary job with the Attorney General's office, working on a lawsuit, ironically, between the state and the Cook Inlet producers over their royalty production tax payments. And his temporary job lasted 10 years. And during that time, he became Director of Petroleum Revenue, responsible for administering the oil and gas tax laws for the state, including separate accounting tax. And on Friday the 13th, in 1979, Governor Hammond chose Tom as his Commissioner of Revenue. And he held that office till 1982. He's worked in private practice, he's worked for SERI, and he's been with British Petroleum since 1987. He is uniquely qualified to talk about taxes and ELF because he's the conceptual father of the economic limit factor. We have a great deal of fun with that sometimes. And while he was working for the state, came up with the central idea for ELF and came up with many of the ideas that drive the tax system the way it is now. We're very lucky that he has agreed to chair the tax committee and to provide you with this overview. He is going to take about 45 minutes, which will constitute a miracle, and then we're going to finish off in the next 10 minutes. And Mr. Chairman, if we could go through without questions, we would appreciate it because that will shorten the time.
Let's do that. How about if we go through without questions, but then as members accumulate, then we can get those addressed after the presentation. Would that be all right? Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Williams. We do have a written statement and written slides that accompany it, and as Judy said, we're not going to read that all into the record. I will talk through the slides, but I would ask that the written statement and the slides be made part of the record of this hearing, if that's okay.
Sure.
Thank you. I will mostly talk from the slides. I have a few little introductory remarks that I'm going to, I'm sorry, read.
Sure.
We're here to provide you with a briefing about Alaska's current oil and gas system, what it is and how it works. Once there's an understanding of how it works and why it was designed the way it is, you'll probably be better prepared to answer the question, does Alaska's fiscal system serve the state's interest today? First, what is the state's interest? And I think the answer is best articulated in a briefing contained in the Department of Revenue's own fall 2002 Revenue Sources book. Alaska's revenue forecasts always count on new production, and never more so than now. Second, and now this is a quote, the key for increased production is that producers need to spend money so that the state can make money from its oil resources. Another quote, there is no question that state government policy decisions will affect the level of investment in North Slope exploration and development. The balance sought is to take a healthy share of the profits derived from oil while remaining competitive in the world marketplace for oil and gas investment dollars. That's the end of the quotes. The challenge then for you as the policymakers of this state is to find the sweet spot that balances keeping Alaska competitive for new investments against taking a healthy share of profits for the state. What are the key facts and the key issues? First, oil prices are volatile. This is a fact. The question is, does Alaska's fiscal system protect the state's interest when prices are low and when prices are high, as they are now? Second, oil and gas companies investing in or deciding to invest in Alaska all have investment opportunities in oil and gas provinces around the world. Alaska competes with these other provinces for investments. This is a fact. The question is, does Alaska's fiscal system make Alaska more competitive or less competitive for new investment dollars? Third, oil production has fallen by half since 1989. To hold production steady at just under 1 million barrels a day to 2015, the state is relying on new investment and new production from four sources: heavy oil, ongoing infield development, satellites, and wildcat exploration. This is a fact. The question is, does Alaska's fiscal system encourage or discourage new investment in each of these areas? We're going to give you kind of an overview now from 60,000 feet about how Alaska's fiscal system works, what the state share is, how the ELF, like Rodney Dangerfield, gets no respect, and the best test approach for determining Alaska's competitive position. Now we'll go to the slides. You can see in this slide how important oil and gas revenues are to Alaska now. The current fiscal year, almost 90%, 88 I think is the percentage of the unrestricted general fund revenues are coming from, projected to come from petroleum, and only the sliver you see there in red from the non-petroleum sources. More important, as the revenue sources book says, oil revenue will provide at least 75% of the unrestricted revenue through fiscal 2014. Two elements are critical to the oil revenue forecast, price and volume. Now there's not a lot we can do about prices, but there is stuff that we can do about volume. And that's going to be the questions here. There are opportunities, and you will have to judge whether it's more important to grow the pie or to take a wider slice out of it, and recognize that sometimes the pies then are not going to be the same size. There are four elements right now to Alaska's present fiscal system. These are from the actuals for 2004. You see the royalty accounts for just over $1 billion into the general fund and just under $500 million to the permanent fund. The production tax was $650 million to the general fund last year. Property tax to the state was $47.3 million, and another $218.7 went to municipalities. And the corporate income tax paid by oil companies was just under $300 million last year. The total is $2 billion to the general fund, $703 million to others. Now, when you work with a budget, generally the number that you're familiar with is the $2 billion number. But from our point of view, it's the $2,750,000,000 number, $2.75 billion. That's the one that's important, because that's the total cost of the fiscal system. I talk about each of these different components a little bit. Royalty is the state's ownership. share. It comes from the fact that the state is the landlord. It owned the land, and it made a contract for the use of it. It's different from the other revenue sources in that it doesn't involve an inherent sovereign right of the state, but merely its right as the landowner to make a contract for the use of its land. In that sense, if you or I had owned the land at Prudhoe Bay, we could have made exactly the same leases with the oil companies as the state has made. We'd have exactly the same rights and entitlements under those leases as the state currently has. Being a state under the royalty contracts is not being magical. It's just simply being a party to a contract, the same as you or I. Until 1979, most of the leases, well, virtually all of them, had a standard 1/8 royalty clause. And then starting in 1979, some leases were offered with higher royalty rates. The states got the choice of taking either the physical oil represented by its share or the value of it, in effect selling it to the producer. The royalty in kind is delivered to the state in the field, where it goes through the meters from the field facilities into the pipeline that transports the oil away. The royalty in value is based on the value at that meter. It's called a netback value because, in fact, you don't usually have a lot of sales in the field. So here's an illustration of how the netback methodology works. You can see that the red line going across Alaska is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It goes from Prudhoe Bay down to Valdez. From Valdez, it's loaded onto ships, and then it goes to the West Coast. One West Coast destination that's not shown there is Hawaii. It's another one that can go to. But basically, you have refineries on the West Coast in the Puget Sound area, San Francisco Bay, and the Los Angeles Long Beach area of California. You start with the price there. It's a spot price. You can see it in the Wall Street Journal. Or any other, many other newspapers. In this case, let's say that it's a $25 price. That's for the oil delivered on the West Coast. To get the net back, you have to subtract out the costs of getting it from the field to the West Coast. The first part that's subtracted out is the marine transportation. That's $1.61 a barrel. That's in black because so are the boat lines in black. Then TAPS is $3.05. That leaves you $20.34 back at pump station one. In the case of Prudhoe Bay, pump station one is where the meters are that the oil goes into the pipeline from, so that's your netback value for Prudhoe Bay. You've got other fields on the slope that have more pipelines they have to go through, like Kuparuk goes through a pipeline, Endicott, Milne Point, Alpine. They all go through a system of pipelines on the slope to get to pump station one, so you would subtract out the individual pipeline tariffs that oil from one of those fields goes to get back to its netback. I might add that these numbers are, the 2004 numbers average from the Department of Revenue. So these are fairly representative, except for my assumption about a $25 price. The production tax is a tax on the act of producing the oil and gas. The amount of tax is the product of ELF, times a base tax rate, times gross resource revenue. And that gross resource revenue is important because it's the value at that same custody meter where the oil goes from the field into the pipeline. Field costs are not deductible. They're not deductible for production tax, and they don't show up for royalty. The state gets the value at that point, at that meter. That's what the state gets. So the taxable volume is equal to total volume amount minus the state's royalty share, and the net back value times that gives you the gross resource value. But there's no deduction for either one for the cost. It's off the top. Excuse me. The base rate that you apply the ELF to for gas is 10%. For oil, it's 12.25% during the first 5 years of a field's production, and then it goes to 15% after that. Now, what is the ELF? The ELF is a number that you calculate for each field. It's 0.1. It's based on field size and well productivity, and those are the two key things. Larger fields have larger ELFs and higher tax rates. Similarly, fields with more productive wells have larger ELFs and higher tax rates. Smaller fields or low productivity fields have smaller ELFs and lower rates. The gas ELF is only based on well productivity. Now, the property tax is totally different kind of critter. This is one that you're probably familiar with from your own homes. Here, it's totally unrelated to the price of oil and gas, just like your home is probably valued totally independent of what it costs to heat it. Here, it's unrelated to the price of the oil and gas. It's coming out, and rather, it's the value of the assets, the physical property that's there. The state assessor determines the taxable value of it. Taxable property is only property that's used in exploration, production, or pipeline transportation of oil and gas. It does not include gas utility facilities, however. So for gas utility, its pipelines don't get counted. And that's a specific exclusion in the statute. The amount of the tax is 20 mils per dollar, or 2% of the assessed value that the state puts on it. When property is within a municipality, that municipality can tax that property at the same rate it taxes its local residents and their property. The city can't discriminate against oil and gas property by putting on a higher rate. So whatever the local residents are paying, that's the rate that would apply to the oil and gas property in that city. The amount that gets paid to the city for that property is a credit against the state tax. So if you had a 20 mil tax on a property X in a city that had 15 mils as its millage, then the 15 mils that are paid to that city would be a credit against the 20 to the state, and the state would receive the other 5. That's why in the opening slide you saw $41 million going to the state and over $200 million going to municipalities. It's because of the local levies. The corporate income tax. Now, this is sometimes a confusing tax, but I'll try not to confuse you with it. First of all, it applies to all for-profit corporations in Alaska, except for the ones that aren't treated as corporations. Subchapter S corporations are treated as partnerships, and limited liability corporations are treated as partnerships. So they're invisible for tax purposes, and they don't count them. They're not really corporations. So for the other for-profit corporations, here you have this tax. For all the corporate taxpayers who are taxed, you have the same rates and the same tax brackets. For instance, the first $10,000 of your Alaskan income as a corporation is taxable at 1%. Second $10,000 is taxed at 2%, the third at 3%, and so on. Everything over $90,000 of Alaskan income that you have would be taxed at 9.4%. That's the top bracket. These brackets apply to everybody. The other thing is, how do you calculate for a multi-state business, how do you calculate how much income of its business is attributable to the Alaska pieces of its business? How much did it really make here? All of multi-state corporate taxpayers use apportionment. And here we have an example, Walmart and Oil Co. Now, Walmart is in quotation marks because I don't really know what Walmart's actual situation is, so I'm holding them up as a representative example. It's a hypothetical, but one that we're familiar with. Basically, Alaska is going to take a slice of Walmart's income from its U.S. business and deem that slice to have been earned from the Alaska business activities. So that's what you start with Walmart. It's a pie of income that's the U.S. income pie. Then the slice is calculated on the basis of the percentage of Walmart's U.S. property that's in Alaska, the percentage of its U.S. sales that are in Alaska, and the percentage of its payroll in Alaska. You take the average of those three percentages, and that's the width of the Alaskan slice. So if Walmart had $1 million of income and the Alaska slice was 5%, you'd have $50,000 of Alaskan income. The first 10,000 would be taxed at 1%, the second at 2%, and so on up to 50. So that's how they would be taxed. Now for Oil Co., it's the same basic idea, except it's the whole world, because most of the companies that are here in Alaska do business worldwide. There's some unfavorable adjustments that are made to the income on a worldwide basis that unfavorable relative to a Walmart or any other corporate taxpayer. Oil companies are only allowed to take a slower rate of depreciation than the non-oil companies. So that's one thing. There's certain things about intangible development costs that we have that mines and others get to accelerate or write off all at once, and we don't. So there's a few things like that. These are not favorable for us relative to the other taxpayers. The slice of the pie, how do you calculate the width of the slice, is the same approach as for the Walmart. For the first two factors, it's the percentage of your worldwide property, now because it's worldwide income, worldwide property that's in Alaska, percentage of the worldwide sales. And then Alaska, for oil companies, uses the percentage of worldwide production. And the reason for that primarily is the upstream business, oil and gas, is not labor-intensive. What's an oil company without oil and gas production? I mean, so that was, those two reasons were why Alaska decided to substitute production instead of payroll. But again, if you had, Oil Co. had $1 million of income and 5% of it was the average of these three percentages for Oil Co., you'd have 50,000 of Alaskan income. The first 10,000 would be taxed at 1%, the second at 2%, and so on. Exactly the same as in the Walmart situation. Now, one of the things that's interesting is how these pieces fit together. Royalty is sensitive to price volatility. If the market price of oil goes up a dollar or down a dollar, that rise flows straight back to the wellhead because the transportation costs essentially are the same. So your net back value in the field goes up a dollar. If it falls by a dollar in the marketplace, the net back value basically falls by a dollar. So the oil royalty is very vulnerable with oil prices. It's sensitive to it. The production tax is a similar sort of thing. It's sensitive to it. The one protection in the production tax against very low prices is that there's a cents per barrel floor against severe downsides. Basically, if your percentage of value gets below this floor price, an 80 cents per barrel tax rate kicks in instead. So at a 15% rate, that's at $5.33 is where that floor is. Below that, you would be paying the 80 cents per barrel rate times the ELF instead of 10% of the value, or I'm sorry, 15% of the value times the ELF. Now, what are the takeaways that I'd like you to have if remembering about each of these things? First, royalties are the mainstay of Alaska's revenue system. They're half of almost half of the general fund unrestricted revenues, and they're by far the largest source of oil and gas revenue today. Every field on state land in Alaska pays state royalty. Royalty does come off the top, doesn't take into account the cost of exploring, developing the field, or the cost of operating it. Royalty in kind gives the state opportunities to develop or encourage value-added industry here in Alaska, and we have several refineries in this state because of what the state has done with its royalty oil. The other thing is while royalty goes up and down, when prices go up and down, it never goes away until production stops. The other thing about, well, the takeaway points that I would have you remember about property tax are, first, the bulk of it goes to municipalities. It's price neutral. It doesn't depend on the price of oil and gas. It's unrelated to them. And the third thing about property tax is the robustness of the tax depends on the health of the oil and gas industry and the companies that are owning the facilities being taxed. If the industry is in decline or a field is shut in, the tax is immediately affected. Corporate income tax, the takeaway points here. The same tax brackets, and same rates apply to oil companies as for other Alaskan corporate taxpayers. For both, apportionment is used to determine how much income was made from the Alaska piece of the business when you have a multi-state business. Oil companies are required to use worldwide, and everyone else uses what's called water's edge, just their U.S.-only business. The apportionment factors are similar. They both rely on the in-state percentage of sales, the in-state percentage of property. The only difference is, as I explained before, for oil companies, it's the in-state percentage of production. For everyone else, it's the in-state percentage of the payroll. And the whole thing that of the whole system here, as you can see, is you have kind of a balance. You have a couple of, you have one revenue source, royalty, that's sensitive to oil and gas price fluctuations. The production tax is also sensitive, but it does have this cents per barrel floor. Property tax, though, is immune. And the income tax, as you see, is moderate. What can happen when oil prices are very high, there's usually resistance at the retail level to pass that all through. It tends to be that the margins get compressed very often. And so the downstream business of refining and marketing refined products is squeezed. Now, not always, but oftentimes that is the case historically, that high upstream profits at the production end of an integrated business are accompanied by lower profits in the downstream business. It also happens that when you have lower oil prices, the other margins can widen. The downstream business can also include petrochemicals, which is even less related to how high or how low oil and gas is. So that's a cyclical business that sometimes is making profits and sometimes isn't. So Alaska has kind of a natural counterbalance on the income tax that's built in there. In general, when the state is going gangbusters in the upstream business, there's less attributed going into the pie from the downstream business. And conversely, it's often the case that when the upstream business is suffering because of low oil prices, there's still a significant amount of downstream income going into the pie. And so again, that helps to stabilize the swings. Doesn't eliminate them, but they're counterbalancing force. What I'd like to do now is sort of talk to you about the reason for the ALF and the importance of having some sensitivity to it. I would say that during the course of a field, from a producer's point of view, you go through four stages. Remember I said that you have the royalty and the severance tax coming off the top. Here you have the two charts that show royalty and production tax coming off the top. At the very bottom, you see very low production costs, and the big white area in between is the operating margin. This is very healthy for the oil company. This is what you hope for when you go wildcatting, that you get a field that looks like this when you finally bring it on stream. Because now, after decades, perhaps in some cases, or at least many years in all cases, you're finally getting a return on the millions of dollars that you've had out there at risk without a penny coming back. This is the picture that you hope to have that when you start out. But one thing that happens is that oil and gas changes over time. It's a depleting resource. There's nothing new being created in the ground as you take it out. And so that means that in the natural course of things, you're going to have to work harder and harder to get the next barrel of oil out of the ground, or the next cubic foot of gas out of the ground, than the one you just produced. The other thing that happens is that reservoirs change. Over time, you get more gas coming up with each barrel of oil, and that's more cost to separate it and manage it and put it back in the ground. And also, over time, you tend to have more water coming up with each barrel. And again, that means more cost to separate the water and dispose of it properly. It's interesting, you know, how different Prudhoe Bay, and it's a good example just to illustrate it, how different it is now from when it started just over 25 years ago. When Prudhoe Bay first came on stream, it was going to produce, and did produce, 1,200,000 barrels a day from 120 wells, 10,000 barrels a day per well. What an amazing field. That's the average production. Today, it's producing just under 400,000 barrels a day of oil, and there's over 1,000 wells. When it started production, the gas that came up that had to be disposed was about 1 billion cubic feet a day. Now we're injecting over 7.5 billion cubic feet a day and handling 8.5 billion cubic feet a day. In 1979, the water that we had to inject in the reservoir was 23,000 barrels a day. Last year, it was 1,500,000 barrels a day. So the field is very different now. The costs for Prudhoe Bay have gone up, the volume has gone down. And what that means is the black area on the chart has increased over time. And this is not unique to Prudhoe Bay. This will happen to any field. Prudhoe Bay is just an example that I use because it's one we all sort of recognize in our heads. So one thing that happens here that was a concern to the Department of Revenue, this has to do with a historic fact now. Back in the mid-70s, in fact, in 1976, there was a big stalemate in the legislature over whether Alaska should have separate accounting or not. The Department of Revenue did not want to have a separate accounting income tax because we thought a severance tax, a production tax, would be easier to administer and would avoid all kinds of messy disputes and litigation about trying to unwind transactions between affiliates in a vertically integrated oil company. You know, the concern as a tax administrator was you have entity A selling something to B, selling something to C, selling something to D. And in the course of the sales prices here, there was a possibility. I'm not saying any of the particular companies would do it, but we were concerned about the possibility that there could be some creative accounting in the pricing of these things, so that lo and behold, the profits ended up being in the subsidiary that was running on the high seas, for example, and outside Alaska's jurisdiction, and also outside of California's and outside of Washington State, and wow, there's where all the profits are. That was a concern we had as the Department of Revenue. And again, I'm not saying that companies do that intentionally, but there's a concern that we had as tax administrators that some companies might try it. We didn't want to go down that path. Severance tax is nice and simple. And so that was where we wanted to stay. And and so we did. I mean, but the problem we had with the severance tax, that a high rate severance tax that we had, is that it comes off the top. Now at the beginning of a field's life, that doesn't make much difference. And this is, you can hardly see it on this slide. The one on the right, the production tax, is actually smaller in area by 15% of the area of the black area. In other words, 15% of the costs in the black have been taken out in calculating the amount of the production tax. Well, you can hardly tell the difference. From the producer's point of view, look at those operating margins. Hey, I'd take either one. Those are great. What's the problem? The problem is over time. As you see the black area, the operating costs rise and consume a greater amount of the value coming out of the ground, it becomes an issue. Here you see, late in a field's life, that the production costs are consuming a majority of the value, the royalty is still coming off the top, production tax, a high rate production tax like 15%, still coming off the top. Look at how the operating margin is being squeezed. That was the problem we had. Is if that's the only operating margin that's left, you're going to make new investments become uneconomic that shouldn't have been because the share is too high, and ultimately you're going to throw a field into the red sooner than it needs to. So from a producer's point of view, its reaction to dealing with this is, it sort of goes through four stages. One is a do-nothing stage. The second, you have an effect, but it's not material. The second is you start to feel the pain. You want to cut your costs. It also has an impact on your investments because the hurdle gets harder to leap over simply because these costs are starting to chew up a significant amount of the value. The third stage you get to is when nothing you have left as an investment is competitive with your investment opportunities elsewhere. You stop investing in the field. Now, up until this point, the new investments that you have been making, although they're getting fewer and fewer, are still working to slow down the decline rate. Once you stop the investments altogether, the decline rate starts to accelerate to its natural decline rate, and now you're in sort of kind of a death spiral type situation. And phase four comes when you're breaking even or in the red. And the producer has two choices there, can shut in or operate at a loss. Now, why would a producer operate at a loss? Well, sometimes you operate at a loss because you don't think prices are where they're going to stay. You think there's a long-term trend and you're just weathering the storm. 6 years ago, oil prices were $8.16. We did not shut in Prudhoe Bay, but I can tell you it wasn't making a lot of money. Not that was delivered. The netback was a lot less. You weather the storm. You weather the storm in that type of situation. Sometimes also you defer shutting in because you're going to incur a greater cost to terminate. You can't just, you know, walk away and leave open wells that people can fall into. You've got to plug and abandon them. You've got to remove your infrastructure and restore the land. This is part of the obligations under the lease. So there's these costs. And sometimes it's better to operate at a loss for a while than incur that massive investment of winding up. But even so, eventually you get to the end where you just can't go in. So that's the fourth stage, the operating at a loss stage. Now here's an example of how the high severance tax would accelerate you to stage four. Stage four is the condition here. You've got the 15% severance tax. Oh, and guess what doesn't show? If I may, Mr. Chairman, in this slide, I'll point and talk loud. There is a band here that's cross-hatched with black and red, and that's goes up from the top of the black area to the top of this line over here. So imagine that's shaded with stripes. That's your loss, and we should have.
We can see it in our printout.
You can see it on the printout. Yeah. Good. So, well, that's why we have the printout. That's the loss. Now, if you took the production tax away, you still have an operating margin. You've moved from Phase 4 back to Phase 3 or Stage 3, and in fact, depending on what your specific investment opportunities are, you may actually have moved back to Stage 2. You may still have some more investments now that are competitive to make, even with that little margin, if they don't cost a lot and if they get on stream real fast. So you could go back to Stage 2, and you'll certainly go back to Stage 3. The severance tax is the obstacle. Well, the department was pulling its hair out because it wanted to have a high severance tax. How could we do it? And the answer was the ELF. This miracle is, my idea was to look at TP and PEL. Now, what do these things mean? Well, TP is your total production, your current production that a field is producing. PEL is the amount that you needed to cover those costs. How much, in other words, what percentage of the barrel is that black percent, is in that black area that we saw on the previous slide? That's what this fraction asks. What's the percentage that you need to cover those costs of each barrel? That was the cost percentage, and what we called 1 minus that cost percentage, we call that, ugly term, the gravy percentage, because it was the revenue that goes, the net revenue that can go to the producer. It's the operating margin. This thing, when your tax is chewing up more and more of the value of the barrel, this fraction gets larger, the ELF gets smaller, and remember I said when the ELF gets small, so does the tax. So this gets it out of the way. The tax disappears. It does what we saw in that previous slide here. It makes the tax get out of the way, and you have an operating margin left as this production cost is consuming the greater and greater proportion of the barrel. I brought it just so you really see that this is the report that the Department of Revenue issued in 1977 that was the birth of the ELF. This is the first time it saw the public light of day in this report to Governor Hammond, February 1977. It's in here. This is how the Department of Revenue in that report described the problem. Talks about how profit margin shrinks as operating costs rise. And at some point, the costs overtake the value being produced, and then you can only continue by operating at a loss. So this confirms that what I was telling you is, you know, I'm not making this up. I actually remembered it. And but the other thing is that here it is. The Department of Revenue recommends the ELF as a means of eliminating this effect. The Department of Revenue recommends an economic limit factor, or ELF, based on the ratio of the rate of the true economic limit to the current production, as a mechanism for scaling down the tax rate as production declines towards the economic limit. Now, we had an exponent put in by the legislature in the 1977 legislation. Why was it put in? Let's see, does it say? No, it doesn't. The reason it was put in was that Prudhoe Bay could show it needed 1,000 barrels a day to break even, and it was producing 10,000 barrels a day per well. Under the Knudsen formula, which was the original formula, that fraction would be 0.1, 1,000 over 10,000, minus 1, I mean subtracted from 1, gave you an ELF of 0.9. That was too big a tax break in the eyes of the legislature. The exponent took it away. Whether you left the presumption at 300 barrels a day to break even, or showed you needed 1,000 barrels a day, when you calculate it under the right-hand formula, the ELF is 0.95 either way. Now, the mathematics are tricky, and I don't want to take the time to try to explain them, but that's how the formula worked.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Can I ask him just to repeat that last sentence?
Sure.
Thank you. Not the sentence about it being too complicated to explain, but just what the original sentence was.
Well, the exponent went in then, so that whether you showed you need 300 barrels a day per well to break even at Prudhoe Bay, which was the presumption, or whether you showed that you actually needed 1,000 barrels a day to break even, either way, the ELF was the same, 0.95.
Thank you.
And that was what the exponent did.
We're going to test you after this presentation to make sure you got that, Berta.
Got it written down.
It's
okay.
What happened in 1989 was we had field size going to the formula. This number here, 150,000 barrels a day over TP per day, that's the field size. How many barrels a day are you producing from the total field relative to 150,000? The exponent from the original formula that carried over turns into a turbocharger. It accelerates the effect of the first exponent with 150,000 in it. What it does is it says, if you're over 150,000 barrels a day, this is going to cram you up towards 1. The ELF gets closer to 1 from what it otherwise would have been. If you're less than 100,000 barrels a day, it crams you down towards 0. It accelerates you down towards 0. And the rationale was field size. Now, what were the reasons given? One was to get more revenue. And, you know, I'm sorry about the historic. Again, Mr. Chairman, maybe in terms of process, what is your schedule in terms of how long this presentation can go? Because I can try to skip through some of this historical stuff unless you're finding it useful.
I am myself, but I want you to know we have maybe 20 to 30 minutes to go. We budgeted till 7 o'clock as far as our time.
So I just wanted to make sure that was that's the deadline.
But as far as what you presented so far, it's fine with me. We're going to conclude adjourn the meeting at 7 o'clock. So just be mindful of that.
Okay. The reasons to get then I won't read you what the slides say. You can look at them. Reasons given in 1989 for the ELF change: to get more revenue, to give an incentive for small fields, to give an incentive for West Sac heavy oil, and Prudhoe Bay and Chicago could afford it. And here you see a statement that says, you know, our analysis suggests that even with this change in ELF formula, if there is an impact on the investment, there will only be a few days worth of production from the slope, from Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk over a 20-year period. The effects of changing the ELF, the legislature was told that it would reduce the rates for all fields except Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. And in particular, it was said the marginal fields are the 6 Cook Inlet fields and Milne Point, Lisburn, Endicott, Nyakuk, West Sac Point, Thompson, Seal Island, and probably any other field that will be discovered in Alaska. You will hear a lot about marginal fields, but the reason we put this quote here is so you hear what was said. Marginal was not used in the dictionary definition of marginal. Small was marginal. Probably any other field that will be discovered in Alaska would be marginal, unless it was a supergiant. The legislature was told specifically that Endicott, one of those fields in that list, would have reduced taxes under the bill, even though it produced 100,000 barrels a day. So this is a different concept of marginal than the standard concept, the dictionary definition of it. And it's important to understand that, because that's what the legislature was told, not by the industry so much, but by the administration itself, the administration's spokesman. Second effect of changing the ELF was that rates could go to zero. That wouldn't be zero under the old one. And that's, here this quote is, for marginal fields, with that broad sense of marginal, the severance tax could be eliminated entirely. Third thing, smaller fields pay less tax even with the same well productivity. To us, well productivity is one of the big indicators, but even if they have the same productivity, and here was an example that I happened to give testifying in 1989, Prudhoe Bay averaging 500,000 barrels a day per well, and Lisburn at 500 barrels a day per well. Prudhoe was going to be 385,000 barrels a day at that rate. Lisburn, 40,500. The ELF was 1,000 times smaller for Lisburn, tax rate of only 0.016. So the idea that a small field could pay no severance tax was not a surprise. The legislature was told that. Finally, the revenue gains. The state was told that there would be, over the next 20 years, ahead by $2.7 billion. And in fact, it was. Now, one of the things that happened with the introduction of field size is that it became important whether fields stood alone or lumped together. And the original ELF bill, because of the complicated ownership patterns of leases and units and things like that that made up the fields in the Cook Inlet, there was a provision put in the 1977 law, before Prudhoe Bay or anything on the slope started producing, that said where you have economically interdependent production operations being conducted, you can lump together the various pieces of whatever you need to recognize the whole operation. So this was a thing there that allowed the department to go and do it. As an example, though, is that it didn't make much difference if you lumped together or not. You had two fields, A and B, don't have to go through the calculation, just see that it's 44,500 when they stand alone. Lumped together, it was actually $50 less, 44,470. It wasn't a big deal then, whether you lumped together or not. Field size, though, makes all the difference in the world, because suddenly now you've got both fields are a lot bigger by being combined than either was separately. And here's exactly the same fields under the new L formula. See how it rewards smallness? These are marginal fields now, $1,600 combined tax for the two of them under the new L formula, $18,000 if they're lumped together. So that's why lumping together became very important. And that's, in fact, what this recent decision was about, whether the satellite fields, the six satellite fields that are sharing facilities with the main field at Prudhoe Bay, should be lumped together with that main field. Now I'm done, and I can turn it back to Judy, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, sir, thank you very much. I appreciate that overview. It was a good
education. Sorry for the history lesson.
Okay. Judy, before we go to you, do you mind if we see if there's any questions from the committee? Are there any questions at this point before we go to you? Representative Samuels.
Thanks a lot, Tom. On slide 9, did you explain Walmart versus Oil Co.? You had the percentage of the property in Alaska, the percentage of the production in Alaska versus worldwide, and then worldwide sales in Alaska. Is that the sales of Alaska product? It's not sales in Alaska.
Sales in Alaska include the actual refined products that you would sell here, but it also includes the pipeline tariffs. That if you're a pipeline owner in TAPS, for instance, and you're carrying someone else's oil, the pipeline tariffs are part of your sales. And also, the pipeline tariffs you charge your own affiliate for carrying its oil through are sales in Alaska. So those tariff sales are counted in the numerator for the Alaska fraction, and they go into the denominator too because it's part of the worldwide total then.
Thank you. Representative Oakberg.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Williams, in your written comments here, you referred to the Wood and Ag study. In the numbers that you used, were those the numbers that were brought up today by Senator Turio that he had permission from Liz McKenzie to release, or are these numbers that are additional numbers from the 04 report? What's the status of your ability to speak about these?
Hey, may I answer that one, or do you want to answer that?
Well, I will on
Why
behalf of the... to the chair.
Here's the boss.
Representative We've referred in these remarks to both the 2002 study and to the 2004 study that Representative Samuels just announced with Senator Terrio that they're going to release. We ask for the same ability to release information, and we are in the same situation as the state talked about today, the legislature talked about today. We are still reviewing those figures to see what they mean. But the figures that we have released have in there, we have permission to release.
Through the chair, unfortunately, I missed the press conference, and I have a draft. I'm not sure what was released today, so that's why I asked if you have. Obviously, you must have permission to speak about this.
We have permission to talk about certain information, and the. It's about covered in our remarks here.
I've signed a confidentiality agreement, so I guess I'm kind of constrained to ask any questions. That's why I was asking about.
I have a copy of the news release that went out announcing the dissemination of the information. I'm looking for it. Can you give it to you, Representative Roper? Here it is. Are there any more questions before we move on to Judy's presentation? Representative Roper?
Yeah, just the thoughts is that I'm looking on whatever it is. Page 29 says that in the 02 study, the Alaska tax regime, all three, state, local, and federal, tends to stay in the middle of the pack worldwide. although at higher oil prices, it moves the state into a more competitive position. This is positive. It reinforces the concept that governments can influence their competitive position through their tax policies. I guess this is a reference to the O2 study. And this is what I'm getting at. This seems to indicate, Mr. Williams, the testimony you gave before the Ways and Means Committee last spring indicates the policy of the state when you were with the state administration was to create a situation in our multiple sources of petroleum revenues, a greater take for the state of Alaska when prices were low, and a sliding scale, if you will, or a scale situation where as prices increase, the percentages of the state take would go down, albeit, of course, the gross revenues would go up, but the percentages would go down. And there's been some criticism about that. Would you care to comment about that and in terms of any information that you or arguments you can bring before the committee? How's that? Right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, that is how Alaska works, and part of the reason for protecting the downside is that in 1970s and 1980s, early 1980s, when I had some role in the state government, it was our view that oil was just as big a percentage of the budget as it is now. And if it goes down, our revenue is impacted. It would not be the right time to be cutting taxes even further because the oil companies are also being squeezed. When oil revenues fell to less than $1 billion a year in 1986, the states needed, the people needed government services, and that would be the wrong time to be doing a cut for the oil companies. So because of the public need that needed to be fulfilled. So to keep the revenues there, you end up unfortunately taking a larger piece of what's available, a higher percentage. It's balanced out. If you have long-term expectations, it's balanced out. Just like when I said about going through the storm of $8.16 a barrel, you go through those times, you hope that that's not going to be the new world order as an industry and as a state. And so you come back and state then, through this regressive aspect for the tax, gives encouragement to people who are wildcatters because they're hoping that when oil prices are high, they're going to have those nice big white areas in those barrels like I showed in my slides when they bring their fields on. And if the state's taking away the upside, then it's reducing their expectations about what they might get. They don't plan. They don't drill wildcat wells on the assumption of 9 or 10 oil. They're drilling on a long-term expectation that's substantially higher.
Yes, please.
It's a really important point, Mr. Chairman.
No problem.
Something I've been trying to struggle with a little bit so I can explain it to the public, too. Kind of a two-part question. Is our production tax formulation, what is that impact on that formula regarding the upside, low side, particularly the low side? I think I can understand it on the upside, but I'm not sure I understand it on the low side. In other words, how come we get more in the downside? And what's the relationship between production tax take and the other forms of take that are in the equation, the total tax revenue equation?
Right. Well, the production tax is roughly on the order of a quarter of the total petroleum revenues that the state gets. In the past, it was higher because the fields were higher and more robust, and they had higher economic limit factors.
Well, how does it relate to the bigger take from lower prices, higher take, or less, more bigger take from low prices, less take than high prices?
Well, it's an artifact of the fact that when you have that low price, it flows straight back to the wellhead and reduces the wellhead price, or that netback price that we were talking about. So that gets compressed. The royalty comes off the top. The severance tax still continues to come off the top, but the costs don't come down just because prices have. And so you see those margins get squeezed. And when you're looking at what's available between the cost of the barrel and the top of the barrel, after you take the royalty and the tax out, there's very little left. So those two are a high percentage of what's available to be shared at low prices. It's because the netback value is a direct function. Each dollar up is a dollar up in the netback value. Each dollar down flows back as a dollar down in that netback value. And that's what causes the squeeze. That's that percentage to become high. Because we're still not looking at the actual cost of production. We're using these rules of thumb. 300 barrels a day per well and 150,000 barrels a day is the standard field size. Those are rules of thumb that are in the formula to make its administration simpler because it's already complicated enough.
We have two more questions, then we'll go to you, Judy, and we do appreciate your patience in waiting. Thank you. Representative Samuels and then Representative McGuire. Ralph?
Thanks. I can wait until Judy gives her presentation and ask.
Okay. Representative McGuire?
Don't go anywhere.
Just while we're on this point, how do, it's probably going to take more time than you have now, but how do other countries take into account the similar problem that you face when you decide to go out? And is there anything else like it? And I just kind of want to hear a discussion on it, because it's interesting when you look just on this press release here today, when you look at the different prices given are $16 a barrel, $22, and $35. When you look at the percentage that Alaska takes at $16, it's commensurate with what the global average take is. It's about a dollar difference. It's very close. But then as you go to $22 and $35, you start getting a real difference in the percentages. And I'm just wondering, I understand why you did it. I appreciate this presentation because I didn't have the history. I didn't understand, you know, what led to that and all the economics that go into it. But I'm just curious if there are other oil-producing nations or countries that have dealt with it a different way.
Mr. Chairman, yes, there. I mean, I'm not an expert on other countries, so I really can't answer what sorts of things other countries do, but I'm pretty sure that what Alaska has is unique. We have a significant portion of our revenues that come off the top, and we have this one factor in there that compensates for that, tries to offset it so that we don't end up leaving oil and gas in the ground as a field has more and more of its production going to cover the cost of getting that production out of the ground. And that's an artifact of the system that we have. To me, the real question is, are you getting the oil that you should be getting? Are you getting the investments here to keep oil production up? Those are the real questions, as much as, you know, there is competition with the rest of the world, so you don't want to be oblivious to what the rest of the world is doing. But the real question is, are you seeing the investments here that need to be made? Do you expect to see them continue in the future that need to be made to make that future stay at a million barrels a day or so? Those, I would suggest, are the real questions to be asking.
Thank you very much, Tom. Judy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to make this 5 minutes, apparently. We start out with the, this is just to close off, the what we started with, that we all know that oil reserves will continue to be the mainstay for Alaska's economy. And when we get the gas pipeline in Anwar opened, it will continue to be, you know, strong for the next 50 years. What we're going to talk about today a little bit again is price and volume. And as we have said, as Tom said before, we can't do very much about price. There is, however, a cautionary tale about price. I was in the administration, the Cooper administration, in 1987, 88, and prices had just gone from what would now be $60 a barrel to $10 a barrel. I want you to imagine what would happen if a year from now prices fell to $10 a barrel. It was amazing. And we have done that about three or four times in this state. We've hit high oil prices and low oil prices, and our budgets have gone from $3 billion to $1 billion, $2 billion to $1 billion, $2 billion to $931 million in a year. So we can't do very much about prices. Whoops. But we can do something about volume. And production, the big thing that's different between now, well, there's two things, but the big thing that's different between now and 1989 is production. When the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources made this prediction in 1989, most of us didn't believe it. They said 15 years from now, which is now, we're going to be down to about 500,000 barrels a day. We were at 2.1 million barrels a day through the pipeline. And we said, oh, that'll never happen. And boy, it just about did. We got down to a million barrels a day now, half of what the production was then. At that time, we thought we could take, that Prudhoe and Kuparuk could take those big tax hits because they were producing 2.1 million barrels a day. And we knew in the future they would not be able to do that because the costs would increase. The reason that we didn't go all the way down was because of all the investments that were made in Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk and all the technological breakthroughs and all the things that the companies did to make sure that didn't happen. This is what it looked like then, from then till now, where that money went. The black line shows what would have happened if there had not been any investments. We would be today below about 300,000 barrels a day. And even with prices like this, we would not have the budget we have now. We couldn't have made it. The yellow is what happened from the investments. That's the oil from Prudhoe and Kuparuk, the big fields. And the red is heavy oil. Heavy oil began coming on in 1997. Now remember that ELF was passed in 1989 to help satellites and heavy oil. But those fields did not start coming on until almost 10 years later. So they've just actually started to come on. So on the basis of the promise that there would be no tax on those fields, took about 10 years for them to be developed and starting to produce. They are starting to produce, and now we're starting to get talk about taxing them again after the investments have been made. But you begin to see that by 2003, a couple of years ago, the blue lines and turquoise lines and red lines start to become a little more important. The Wildcat exploration is almost entirely, or is entirely, alpine. We have only had one huge new Wildcat field, and we needed about six. This is what happened. This is what the Department of Revenue says we're going to need in the future. They forecast with very hopefully that we're only going to drop from below, from about 900,000 barrels to a little over 800,000 barrels. That would be the least amount of production we have dropped since 1989. In the normal course of events, by 2015, we will be down to 200,000 barrels a day. With investments, the yellow you see again are the investments in the big fields. They still are a huge part. They're our bread and butter fields. But more and more, the reliance is going to be on the satellite fields. And then they're going to rely on the already developed, discovered fields that have not been developed. And at least one of those fields, no one's even taken a look at. It's there, but because of costs and because of some other issues, they're just not looking at. Heavy oil, we expect to be, we hope that with some of the breakthroughs, that there will be more heavy oil showing. And then Wildcat exploration is just pure, we hope it's there from DOR. So to stay at just 800,000 barrels a day for the next few years, that's what it looks like. A whole different picture than it was in 1989 when it was all a two-field, we were a two-field state. All our oil was coming from Prudhoe and Kuparuk. Nothing else counted. They were hoping for more. That's why the legislature said, okay, we're going to hit the big fields hard, but everything else is going to be home free because we need that production. And this is the production they're going to be counting on. The important takeaway points here is that we are in a new world for volume, for production. If we don't get this production, no matter what the prices are going to be, we're going to be in a world of hurt. We are competitive for investment, and the investment formula that we advise people to pay the most attention to is look out the window. If we're getting the money that we need, as Tom said, for new production, then we are competitive. If we're not, then we need to start figuring out why, and that's what the legislature is doing now with the Wood-McKenzie study and the other studies that they're looking at to ask the question, are we competitive? And if we're not, why not? We believe right now that the state's tax system is working the best a tax system can work. It's not the perfect tax system, but it is pretty darn close. You're getting investments in heavy oil, in satellites, in field, and in Wildcat. So we are getting the investments that we need right now with this tax system. The state is getting a consistently high return overall, especially on the medium prices, and even at high prices, you're getting a very substantial return. So we are very much hoping that the fiscal system will stay the way that it is, and as you look at it to see whether it should stay as it is, that you keep in mind that we continue to need these four kinds of investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Any questions for Judy following her presentation? Representative Samuels?
Questions for Tom.
Read your eyes.
But thanks. A couple of technical questions on how do we audit applied tax returns in 800 countries and valuations in several different denominations with the dollar doing poorly, and how do we have a clue what your worldwide sales are?
Well, imagine, you know, we make money in all those jurisdictions. How do we go through all the labor of trying to convert those to federal income tax accounting principles? The Department of Revenue lets us use as a substitute our financial book income. So we have two parts. We have the part that's reported to the IRS for the U.S. business. Then we have the rest of the world that's financial accounting income. And we don't double count the U.S. part. But it's the sum of those two pieces for BP in particular. For other companies that are U.S. headquartered, they're reporting to the IRS their worldwide total, I presume.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely.
On all of the ELF, the formulas they had, the costs obviously is a driving factor. Is it your lawyers against industry and lawyers against the state get in a room with three knives and run for the middle and argue out the costs? Or?
Mr. Chairman, 300 barrels a day now, you can't change it. Even if you could prove that you need 1,000 barrels a day, the statute doesn't allow you to rebut the presumption and show you need the 1,000 barrels a day. Back before that happened, the year after the ELF was passed, in fact, the Prudhoe Bay owners came in and rebutted the presumption and showed, by golly, they needed close to 1,000 barrels a day. But remember what I said about the formula. The ELF was 0.95 either way. And I remember Bob Underwood, who was tax manager for Atlantic Richfield Company, calling me up on the phone after he'd done the calculations and said, do you mean to say that this is exactly the same after we've shown that we need so much more to break even? And I said, yeah, that's the way the formula works. Well, expletive deleted. We won't waste each other's time with that again. I mean, the formula worked very well. It was extremely clever, and there were a number of people in the legislature, but I think it was particularly Mr. Latham who came up with that concept.
Representative,
I've got one left, but I'll defer.
Okay. Representative Roekberg, and then back to Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask Ms. Brady, would you care to comment on the statements made by the governor about his communication with AOGA as an organization regarding his potential administrative order and what, in fact, you perceive to be his message or what did he tell your group? I believe he mentioned on two occasions. Could you describe what he warned you or asked you to do?
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg. No, I wouldn't.
Okay.
we sent a letter that I can. It's a letter that we have given to members of the press to the governor that relates not only what our understanding of what he asked us, but what our response was. And we're perfectly open to giving that letter to anybody who wants to. We are sorry for the misunderstanding on both sides. We're sorry that it happened. And I don't think it serves any purpose to go back through a he said, she said kind of thing. The letter, I believe, speaks for itself, and I'd be glad to give you a copy.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Roekberg. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with you philosophically, both of you. The goal is to, from the state's perspective, obviously, to increase the production and not give away. If we don't think you're going to spend another dime, no matter what we do, then, you know, we're going to tax the heck out of you. And along those lines, would it make more sense, particularly at high prices, to have more exploration credits for those that are making money at a high end? And if you're willing to invest it back in the system, then we're willing to lower the tax rate. And philosophically, without putting on the spot for a particular piece of legislation or idea, but philosophically along those lines, would that be something AOGA would look at more than, I mean, if you're making money up here, if you're willing to spend it back up here, then we're willing to give you a break if you're willing to explore more up here.
Mr. Chairman, you have to have credits that are designed to have an effect on the person who's making the decision you hope is influenced. Right now, the credits that are on the books don't really go and look at what the factors were, the costs were, the types of costs that went into the decision to explore or not explore. The Department of Revenue has tried with its regulations to make them come closer to that, but unfortunately it was presented in a way to you folks to that makes that difficult. You have to be looking at what the decision maker is looking at the relevant parameters, and not and be interested in influencing the decision, not going through with green eyeshade auditors afterwards and second-guessing whether the costs were reasonable or not in each category that were looked at. You have to look at, you know, are these costs what the decision maker was looking at the time of the decision? That's the question, what it should be focused on. The other thing is that the ELF, for some explorers here who are here exploring, is more of an incentive for them to explore than they feel that credit was that was passed a couple years ago. And the reason they feel that is because, in part, explorers are optimistic by nature. They're not exploring on the assumption of $10 oil. They're exploring because they hope that the prices we're seeing now will be more representative during the period when they can bring a field on stream. And so they're interested in, you know, they want a system that makes it Alaska attractive that way. We said that Alaska takes a smaller percentage at high prices, but that makes it attractive for someone who's got millions of dollars out at risk for years and years and years, and then suddenly wants to get as much of that back as they can as their reward for having taken that risk. And that's part of the calculus that comes to play on that. One of the points is that there's the four different kinds of investment we talked to you about. Infield development. Did you know that we spent $200 million last year drilling wells in Prudhoe Bay to slow its decline? But we are. They're draining more areas of the reservoir that the existing wells couldn't get to. We're investing in satellite development. We're investing in heavy oil. We're investing in wildcats as an industry. You got investment in all four areas, and you have to be careful because the economics of one kind of investment don't resemble those of another. A wildcatter has big money up front to acquire the lease, bonus bids or whatever he bids, the cost of the exploration, if it's successful, the cost of confirmation wells, then if it's successful, the big cost of the infrastructure to produce the oil and gas. All of that without a nickel. It's like spending the money to produce the Lord of the Rings trilogy without knowing whether it's going to be a hit. You got all that money exposed and you need to recover it back. The other end is, you know, something that you drill and you see an immediate payout. As soon as you're done doing it, you hook it up, you get the oil coming out of it. That type of investment profile is a very different one. Then it's primarily dictated by how the rock is going to perform in terms of the oil coming up out of that well. So the effect that you do by offering incentive in one area can have carryover effects. Now, not with a direct subsidy type of incentive. What the state's tax policy for one area can have spillover effects in other areas, and you just need to look before you act, hopefully, to see what those other spillover effects are, because otherwise Murphy's Law and the Law of Unintended Consequences are likely to catch up and find out that maybe that was a mistake overall in the long-term interests of Alaska. And that's why we're saying be careful, because you do see the investments now.
Chairman, I'd like to add one thing to that. And there's going to be a lot more hearings, I'm assuming, at least one on this. It's a hard question. Looking back at what we thought in 87, 88, before we changed the ELF then, when you look at what happened to oil prices before that and after that, very high and then very low, and you get a median price of about $18 for 15, 16, 17 years. Even the last 4 years, the median price has been $23. When you get high oil prices, it helps make up over this long run that companies depend on and the state depends on for its fiscal planning. The high end makes up for the low end. And if you start taking, and this is something you'll have to look at and decide for yourself, but if you take off the high end, the median starts to decline. You don't have a decent median anymore. $17.70 over the last 15 years as a median has been hard. It's one of the reasons we haven't gotten the investments. We overreached, I think, and didn't realize that we had become uncompetitive until 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, and all of a sudden looked around and said, wow, we're in trouble as a state. So I hope when you have your hearings, you're going to look at all this. Intuitively, it sounds right. Say, well, if oil prices are really high, you know, we should take more. You don't hear anybody saying all those years that the median was $17. You didn't hear anybody saying, wow, we should really, you know, not take so much. So that's the only thing I would caution against.
I forgot. More high prices and more for people put it back in, even at low prices, if you're willing to keep spending in the state. But that I understand.
I lost track of who had their hand up. I think you had a question, Representative.
Yeah, just real briefly. There's a lot of discussion, obviously, in the halls and around about what the discussions were back when the ELF was created, about its ultimate impact. And in some ways, you can imply through some of the things the governor said that perhaps oil companies were misusing or the formula or making an end run around it. I mean, these are some of the kind of conversations that you hear. But what I've heard you say today is that when it comes to the effects on aggregation, that those were discussed and that that was something that the legislature at least understood would probably change the behavior. I mean, that ELF would change the behavior, the aggregation behavior.
Mr. Chairman, again, I think that's that was a consequence of making field size such a powerful part of the formula in the ELF. It suddenly, to aggregate or not to aggregate, became very much more important. The Department of Revenue has, in fact, adopted a regulation that allows companies to come in that are proposing to share facilities, typically a satellite situation, and get a ruling from the department saying the satellite will have a separate ELF from the field that owns the facilities it's going to share. And so those rulings have been granted. That's how the administrative response has been to deal with the issue. There's standards that are set out in that regulation about what are the criteria the department will use. Because the statutory phrase is economic interdependence. Not interrelatedness, but interdependence. That means each depends on the other. Not that they influence each other, but each one needs the other. And this regulation is how the department has interpreted it. And people have, in fact, gotten rulings. But not everyone.
And just final, Mr. Chairman, would you be willing to provide that to members of the committee? Other members may already have a copy of that regulation, but
I can tell you the citation.
Tell me the cite.
Yes, it's. I happen to know that one.
Good.
It's 15 AAC 55.027, and that's the whole regulation, including the process and the specific standards about whether you get a separate ruling or not, is in subsection B.
Are there any other questions from the committee or any comments before we wrap this thing up? I'd like to state that I would be willing, as the chair of the committee, to explore potential legislation that we could look at that could perhaps offset the effects of the increased taxes. Increased tax collection, I should say. I know it's not a new tax. They're just simply enforcing the state's authority to be able to collect more taxes. But I'm thinking if that does in fact have a chilling effect that we're all concerned about in the industry, maybe there's ways that we can offset that through some additional incentive legislation, tax credits or royalty reductions or something. So I just offer that as a general statement that that's something I, as a member of this committee and chair, would be happy to explore if you have any suggestions along those lines over time. And I also wanted just to make just a general statement, too, for the industry representatives that are here. Thank you for your attendance, too. And just to let you know, there's a lot of folks here in Juneau that do support you and still want to work with you and appreciate all that you've invested in our state and all the wonderful benefits that we've reaped from that as a state, too. So don't get discouraged about the extra taxes that you're paying as of today. And there's a lot of us that really appreciate you and will work with you and contributing to further development in the state of Alaska. So unless there's any further questions, I'd like to wrap up this meeting. But before we adjourn, just to announce that we do have another meeting day after tomorrow on the Thursday, same time, same location. We're going to be hearing from the Department of Revenue as well as the Department of Natural Resources regarding a field development and further discussions having to do with ELF from their perspective. Representative Rochberg?
Chairman, due to the late hour meeting on Thursday, I will be unable to attend because I'll be hopefully on an airplane. But I also would hope that we could discuss about maybe changing the meeting time.
Right.
Running into significant problems here. I prefer to revert to the old 10 a.m. on Tuesday and Thursday if we could.
We'll re-examine that, but there were several reasons as to why we had changed it. But we'll take another look at that, and we'll try real hard to accommodate the committee.
How hard to schedule a 14-hour day right now.
Yes. My day started at 7 o'clock this morning with a budget hearing, so I'm very sensitive to that, too. But to thank you so much, members of the committee, for your patience in that regard, and we'll try to make this work as far as our schedule. And with that, I'd like to adjourn the meeting at 7:10. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Welcome.
You know, it seems like there ought to be a way.